Hello, and welcome to Historically Speaking, Uncommon History with an Unconventional Pair. I'm Rebecca Robbins.
And I'm Kim Kimmel.
I'm a singer and actress.
And I'm a retired history teacher.
He was my history teacher in college.
And now we've been married for 21 years.
Sometimes quirky, sometimes obscure.
But this is the kind of history you actually want to remember.
Hello, and welcome to episode 19 of Historically Speaking Podcast. Today, we are going to talk about something that many of us have heard of, but we don't necessarily know what it means, and that is the Tet Offensive, which has to do with the Vietnam War, which I don't remember, but I think you do.
Yes, that's because I was born in the Mesozoic era.
Well, I wasn't going to say it, but since you put it out there.
So, yes, I was in high school when the Tet Offensive occurred.
So that was a really volatile time for you to be in high school and all this was going on.
Oh, it was everyday news. Yes, absolutely. Tet Offensive began in January of 1968, specifically the last day of January.
And this is in the middle of Vietnam.
This is in the midst.
We've already been there for how many years?
Well, America will be in Vietnam for 20 years, from 1955 to 1975.
That's crazy.
This is 1968. So we've been in Vietnam when the Tet Offensive occurred some 12, 13 years. Just a little background here for our listeners.
And this is New Year's Eve, New Year's Day.
Tet Offensive is the Vietnamese New Year's.
It is the New Year. Okay.
Vietnamese
New Year.
Everybody's
celebrating. It's a happy time.
Yeah, and there was supposed to be a truce between the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, the South Vietnamese, the Americans.
Oh, because of the New Year celebration.
That's right. And that was not observed by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. They took a lot of South Vietnamese and Americans by surprise. But just a little background.
Yeah,
here.
I'd like to know how did this get started?
Vietnam is a very ancient kingdom. It goes way back. It has had a hostility to China and other neighbors for a very long time, long before any Westerners got involved. The French got involved in Southeast Asia in the 1860s. By the late 1880s.
Now, why did they get involved?
Well, because the 19th century was the era of colonialism for Western powers in Africa, in Asia, and elsewhere. I mean, look at British India,
right?
Which goes the whole way back to the 18th century. I mean, some colonialism goes back even further than that with respect to Europe. I mean, Spain in the 16th century, in Latin America, in Mexico, and in South America, and so on.
So it was just that time. Everybody was...
Well, yes. I mean, and every region of the world has engaged in colonial expansion to the extent that they are able. It's just that the West developed a great many technological innovations which made them able to be more efficient at colonial endeavors. But imperial
so
and colonial
powers. The French
powers,
had their sights on that Vietnam area.
They did. And the French began to move into Southeast Asia in the 1860s. By the late 1880s, they had developed French Indochina, which included Vietnam and Cambodia. Now, Vietnam traditionally was divided into three areas. In the northern third was Tonkin, in the middle third was Annam, and in the southern third was Cochin China. And these three areas of Vietnam, along with Cambodia, were formed in the French Indochina in the late 1880s. In the 1890s, the French added Laos to French Indochina.
Okay.
And so this was all part of the French colonial empire, which existed until 1940, when France fell to the Nazis in 6 weeks during World War II, and Germany's ally, the Japanese, moved in and took over French Indochina.
Oh, so that kind of gave them permission.
Well, I don't know.
I guess, did the French just flee?
No, actually, the Japanese kept a lot of French officials, just bureaucrats working on a daily basis just to run things. But everybody knew who the boss was from 1940 to 45.
And that was
the Japanese. Now, in the midst of this, in 1941, a resistance force was formed called the Viet Minh. This is the predecessor of North Vietnam, and its leader was Ho Chi Minh, who was born, we think, in 1890. It's hard to say exactly when he was born.
Okay.
And the Viet Minh opposed Japanese imperialism, Japanese control of Vietnam, and Southeast Asia.
So would you say these are kind of equivalent to the French resistance fighters?
Kind of, yes. In fact, Americans actually worked with the Viet Minh during World War II. There was actually cooperation.
So they wanted complete independence or just independence from Japan?
Well, see, that was part of the problem. Okay. The Americans and the French assumed that the Vietnamese wanted independence from Japan, but the Vietnamese really wanted independence from everyone.
Which I can't blame them.
So when the Japanese were finally defeated in 1945, the French thought that they could come back and just pick up where they left off and, you know, reestablish their colonial empire and all that. Well, that didn't happen because the Viet Minh who had fought the Japanese now began to fight the French. And this is really the first Indochina War. The first Indochina War will last from 1946 to 1954. This war is basically the Viet Minh led by Ho Chi Minh.
Okay.
Against the French. Now, the Americans...
And this is all through all three sections of Vietnam?
Yeah, especially in the north.
Okay.
Especially in the north. That's where the Viet Minh had the most power. That's where they're most concentrated, around Hanoi and in what we would call North Vietnam in the Tonkin area. And the Americans, under Truman, aided the French. We gave them supplies, but no Americans were involved. We just gave them military supplies and so on.
So how many French troops were there?
Oh, tens of thousands.
Oh,
it was a great many that were there. And this is all during the France's Fourth Republic, which would last from 1946 to 1958. Well, the French did very badly. By 1954, the French were defeated at a major battle called Dien Bien Phu, which actually lasted 2 months from March to May of 54. And in the midst of this battle, the Geneva Conference was held, trying to settle all of this mess in Indochina, not just Vietnam, but Laos, Cambodia, so on, and even Korea. So all of this is going on at once. The French are losing to the Vietnamese, the Viet Minh. And once they do in 1954, this is where the Americans come in.
Now, so was it a definitive loss?
Oh, it was a major loss. It was a huge loss. Dien Bien Phu was a disaster for the French.
For the French.
Absolute disaster. I mean, they pulled out of the entire Indochina area after that.
Okay.
They gave up. They just gave up. And America was concerned that Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh were very pro-communist, which they were by admittance, and that they could no longer back the Viet Minh, Ho Chi Minh, because of this was the Cold War, and this could be more extension of communism. So it was the Cold War psychology that brought America into Indochina when the French basically left after Dien Bien Phu.
So it was a stopper to keep communism from spreading.
Right. I mean, even the Truman administration felt that it was very possible that if we did not keep communism from taking over Indochina, there would be a spread of it. And President Eisenhower, who would be president from 1953 to 1961, was the first that we know of to use the term the domino theory, that if Vietnam fell, then Laos would fall, then Cambodia would fall.
Oh, the whole area.
That Thailand, perhaps Burma, like a collection of dominoes. Okay. The domino theory is dismissed by many people today, but I think it has some merit because eventually Vietnam did go communist, as did Laos, as did Cambodia. And the domino theory has merit in the opposite direction with respect to Eastern Europe at the end of the Cold War, when the Soviet Union in 1989, 1990 indicated that they were no longer going to try to enforce power in Eastern Europe. Various Eastern European countries, East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and so on, fell like dominoes out of communist rule. So I think the domino theory has some merit. I'm not saying it's completely valid, but I'm also saying that it's not completely invalid. And this was President Eisenhower's, President Kennedy's, President Johnson's point of view, too. If we let Vietnam go, well, others could go.
So that's why it was so important to the Americans.
Yes. It was all part of a much larger phenomenon, the Cold War. And I think it's important to see Vietnam as a major battle, as you can Korea, as you can the whole matter of Eastern Europe, as all part of what was going on from 1944, 1945, until the end of communism in the Soviet Union in 1991. Yes.
Okay.
And then China gets into this mix too, but I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. Now, in 1954, There was the Geneva Conference.
Right.
And it decided that Vietnam would be divided at the 17th parallel of latitude, that there would be a North Vietnam and there would be a South Vietnam.
Oh, that's where that was decided.
That's where it was decided.
Did the Vietnamese have any say in that?
They agreed to it. The Vietnamese at Geneva agreed to it. The plan was to have federal elections in 1956. Okay, so it would be delayed for a year and a half, 2 years. And then whoever won the election would be able to take over all of Vietnam. But what happened was, in 1954, 1955, Bao Dai, who was the puppet emperor of the French, came back as emperor of South Vietnam. He was overthrown by his prime minister, Diem, who became president of South Vietnam. And Diem refused to have the elections.
Oh.
Which everyone thought, if they had been really fair, Ho Chi Minh, the North Vietnamese communist leader, would have won easily. But President Eisenhower and others had information to the effect that if Ho Chi Minh won, which he probably would have, there would be a mass slaughter, especially...
He would just take over and mow everybody down.
And all of his opposition, especially the 10 to 12% of the population that was Roman Catholic. When the French ran Indochina, there was a small percentage of Vietnamese, some 10%, something in that area, that became Roman Catholic, very pro-French.
Were they in a specific area?
No, they were spread out.
Spread out,
right.
Just dotted through the
I mean, Ho Chi Minh
country.
Studied in France, Diem studied in France, and so on.
Oh, so they probably spoke fluent French.
Ho Chi Minh spoke Chinese, English, French, as well as his native Vietnamese.
Wow, so he was no dummy.
Ho Chi Minh. I think Ho Chi Minh is looked upon as the father of modern Vietnam, but in many ways he was quite brutal. And like Mao Zedong, he eliminated opposition to him rather ruthlessly.
Well, that's interesting because you see people with portraits of Mao Zedong, say, in their living room, but you don't see people with portraits of...
Well, Ho was very much admired in Vietnam and still in certain areas.
People were brutal.
They were brutal. Yes, they were brutal. And Ho Chi Minh actually... In 1945, 1946, when the war was coming to an end, World War II was coming to an end, and the French were trying to get back in there, he actually appealed to the United States, to President Truman, to support him against the French because they just wanted to be independent. But because he was communist, Truman, then Eisenhower, then LBJ, Kennedy, then LBJ, and so on, were not very favorable to that idea. But I think it's important to understand that Ho Chi Minh has to be seen not only as a communist, but also as a nationalist, as an ardent Vietnamese. And it's a mix. And the Americans didn't quite understand that. I mean, it's interesting how many times when you were involved with war, the opposition doesn't really understand you. I mean, Hitler and his hierarchy really didn't understand the United States. The Japanese didn't understand the United States, except Admiral Yamamoto, whom we mentioned in a previous podcast.
But that's because he had been here.
He had studied at Harvard and so on. But it works the other way, too. The Americans didn't quite understand the entire psychology of Vietnam and Southeast Asia and so on. And that is always a problem when you come with a mindset from one region of the world. And you try...
Like, we know what's best for you and we're going to show you.
Yeah, we try to... you try to understand it in your terms rather than their terms.
It seems like we just keep repeating that over and over and over.
Oh, man never learns.
But I mean, when you put young men and women in harm's way, putting forward your ideas, and we think this is what's best for your country.
Well, many skeptics and cynics from antiquity onward have said it's the old men who start the wars, and it's the young men who have to wage the wars.
That is so true. True even to this day.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that.
All right, so we have to get to the Tet.
Well, okay, but let me just say this. When the French really lost everything in 1954 and the Geneva Accords said, okay, we're going to have a temporary division between North and South Vietnam and then
now,
election.
Was there a wall? Was there something?
There was a DMZ. There was a demilitarized zone at the 17th parallel where neither North Vietnamese or South Vietnamese were supposed to go. Of course.
Kind of like North Korea and South Korea.
That's exactly right. Of course, it wasn't really observed.
I see.
It was de jure, not de facto. And What happened was Bao Dai comes back as emperor of South Vietnam, and he's thrown out 1 year later by his prime minister, Diem, who makes himself the first president of South Vietnam. Now, Diem was an ardent Roman Catholic. He was very anti-communist. The Americans were very pro-Diem. I mean, they felt that he was the best guy they had there. Now, Diem had a younger brother who was an associate of his, very close to him, and that younger brother was married to a beautiful Vietnamese woman, Madame Nu, who was very much detested by many in South Vietnam because she was an ardent Roman Catholic. She did not favor the majority Buddhists. She made a lot of statements that were very controversial. And Diem's older brother was the Catholic Archbishop of Hue, the chief Catholic cleric in South Vietnam. So it's very important for people to understand that the 10 to 12% Catholic element was really in control of South Vietnam. And this was resented by the largely Buddhist element that existed in South Vietnam, not to mention those who were pro-communist. So in South Vietnam itself, you had a great deal of division, and the Americans are trying to pack South Vietnam. Now, President Eisenhower sent over some hundreds of military advisors after the French left, and we gave them military material and other assistance. But by the time Eisenhower left office in 1961, we only had some 800, 900, maybe 1,000 military advisors there.
And they were just advisors. They were soldiers.
They were advisors and they weren't. They went out into the field oftentimes. So, yes, theoretically.
Were they doing maneuvers? Were they doing
training?
Yeah,
I mean, they were basically, some of them were basically out in the field, although they were technically only military advisors.
Okay.
And the Army of South Vietnam was known as the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. The acronym is ARVN, A-R-V-N. And the Army of North Vietnam was the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army. In addition to the NVA, in addition to ARVN, you also had the Viet Cong. The Viet Cong were South Vietnamese communists that were in league with the NVA. So you had a very complex situation.
Especially in the South.
Especially in the South. There were many communist sympathizers in South Vietnam. And we really got into a hornet's nest. And we had advice.
We knew all this. This was not something we figured out once we got there.
We kind of sort of knew this, yeah. We kind of did, as we did in Korea, as we did in Eastern Europe, as we did in the Middle East. The Cold War was a treacherous, complex, very convoluted time. We won some battles in the Cold War. We lost some other battles. We won the Cold War overall. But I think you can look upon the Vietnam experience as a battle that we lost.
A high price.
Oh, yeah. Especially the 58, 59,000 American soldiers who were killed. Now, when Eisenhower left office in 61, we were still just having, technically speaking, just advisors advising the South Vietnamese Army, ARVN.
Meanwhile, are there battles happening
on a
regular basis?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. In the late 50s. And then when JFK came into office in January of 61, JFK increased the number of advisors from around 900 to 1,000 to, by the time 1963 rolled around, to around 16,000.
16,000 advisors?
Yes. And these advisors,
soldiers.
They're military personnel. They're out in the field with ARVN, with the South Vietnamese Army. Many times they're in combat.
Are these enlisted Americans?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So just regular guys,
right,
and gals just over in Vietnam,
yeah,
as advisors.
Yes, and some of them were very capable. And once Kennedy was assassinated in 63, and Kennedy did have some doubts about Diem. Let me just back up here just a little bit. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963. 3 weeks before Kennedy was assassinated, Diem, who had been president of South Vietnam since 1955, was assassinated.
Oh, wow.
His brother was assassinated in a military coup by the South Vietnamese military, who were tired of Diem.
Now, are these the communist sympathizers?
No, these were the non-communists. These were members of ARVN, the South Vietnamese Army.
Oh, but they just weren't happy with the way things were going.
That's right. And they felt Diem was corrupt, too pro-Catholic, too anti-Buddhist. There had been Buddhist demonstrations.
It just doesn't seem like this is a Buddhist thing to do.
Well, just to give you one example of the disparity that existed between Buddhists and Catholics in South Vietnam, before Kennedy was assassinated, on June 11th, 1963, an elderly Buddhist monk set himself afire. It's a very famous photograph. Many of our listeners might recall that photograph. He set himself afire. He immolated himself in protest to the Diem regime. And it was felt that Diem favored Catholic officers, Catholic this, Catholic that. So you had not only the Viet Cong within South Vietnam opposing Diem, you had a lot of dissatisfaction by the bulk of the South Vietnamese people who were Buddhist against the Catholic hierarchy that was run by Diem.
So this is almost a religious war that we're having down in the South.
There was a religious element there, was a cultural element in all of this. And complicating all this is that the North Vietnamese developed what was known as the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos and Cambodia to bring supplies furtively to the Viet Cong in South Vietnam, who were fighting both the Americans and the South Vietnamese Army. Now, in 1964, when Lyndon Baines Johnson is president, when LBJ is president, an event occurred in August of 64 called the Tonkin Gulf Incident, where North Vietnamese torpedo boats fired upon American ships. We know that happened on August 2nd. The one on August 4th is problematical. But Johnson got the Tonkin Gulf Resolution passed by Congress almost without opposition on August 7th, which basically gave him a carte blanche to do whatever he wanted.
Oh.
Yes.
Short of a declaration of war.
Yeah, de facto, not de jure. I mean, basically, it wasn't a technical declaration of war, but it basically gave the president to do whatever he felt was necessary. Now, Johnson was up for election as president. He had succeeded to the presidency once Kennedy was assassinated. So he was running in his own right in November of 64 against Goldwater. So he kind of played it quietly for the rest of 64 because he didn't want the Vietnam War to be a major issue.
How was the American sentiment at this point towards that?
The American sentiment was overwhelmingly behind Kennedy, behind Johnson, anti-communists,
we should be
there, and so on.
Okay.
That's right, at this point in time. So Johnson gets reelected in November of 64 in a landslide against Goldwater.
Right.
He comes into office in his own right in January of 65. In March of 65, just a couple months into his new administration, we begin what is known as Operation Rolling Thunder.
Okay.
Operation Rolling Thunder is really removing the mask of just having advisors there. This is a full-fledged war we're going into. We start to bomb North Vietnam on a regular basis. On March 8th, Operation Rolling Thunder started on March 2nd, 65. On March 8th, we land our first troops. We're not just talking advisors here. We're talking combat troops.
I see. These
and,
are the GIs.
And this is when the Vietnam War really becomes an American war in early 1965.
Now, and how many troops did we send over in this for Operation Rolling
Thunder? By the end of 1965, I think we had close to 100,000.
Oh, so a lot.
By 1969, we would have over 500,000.
That is
And remember, Eisenhower started with maybe 600 military advisors in 1955.
Getting bigger and bigger.
Mission creep. Yeah. And there was, in 1965, 1966, there was basically major backing for the war. And William Westmoreland was our chief military officer in Vietnam from 1964 to 68. We were being told by Lyndon Johnson, the president, by William Westmoreland, by the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, we were winning the war. We were winning the war.
Oh, 65
and 66, we were winning the war. But see, American casualties kept piling up. And this became the first war in history that was a TV war. I mean, every night on the news, it was about Vietnam.
Oh, because I guess, sure, during World War II, we didn't
And the Korean War is just at the beginning of TV. And that was not broadcast on a regular basis like the Vietnam War was. I mean, I remember as a teenager, every single night it was about Vietnam. And every single night you were hearing about American casualties. And then other things started coming out. You know, that ARVN, the South Vietnamese Army, wasn't very good. I mean, I've spoken to many Vietnam veterans, and I've never heard one praise the South Vietnamese Army. Maybe there are some out there who do, but I've never experienced that. And they didn't really even trust them. So what a mess. But
Americans are starting to get more angry and more angry.
There's still backing for the war. There was never a point with any poll where the majority of Americans turned against the war. Many Americans felt, however, we were not fighting the war the right way. You mean you either get in and you win it or you get out. You don't, excuse the expression, half-ass it.
Were we holding back? I mean, because if we were bombing North Vietnam...
We were bombing North Vietnam, but we couldn't invade North Vietnam.
Why couldn't we?
Well, because Johnson didn't want to do that. He was
worried. It was a presidential decision.
It was the same reason why Truman was worried about what MacArthur did in Korea in 1950, 1951. And that is, we were worried about World War III. Because, you see, the Chinese and the Russians were backing North Vietnam. And if we invaded North Vietnam, LBJ was worried that we could start World War III, just as Truman was worried when MacArthur wanted to invade China across the Yalu River to prevent Chinese supplying North Koreans, that could start World War III. So this was incremental war.
So basically they have to fight with one hand tied behind their back.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, in many ways you could say that, yes. And I think the American military did its job. There's no question about that. I don't think anybody denies that. I mean, we won every major battle in the Vietnam War, but we lost the war. We never lost a major battle. And the most major of all battles is the Tet Offensive. Right. Now, by the end of 1967, we were being reassured again and again by General Westmoreland, by President Johnson, Americans, that we were winning the war. Okay, it was just a matter of time. We were winning the war. There was attrition of the Viet Cong. We were bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail. We were bombing North Vietnam, and victory was in sight.
Okay, that's
well, then came Tet. January 31st, 1968, in over 100 towns and cities, Viet Cong, supported by the North Vietnamese, attacked everywhere. I think out of some 44...
You mean throughout the South?
Well, there were 44 provinces in South Vietnam, and I think they attacked in something like 36 of them.
Oh my gosh, how did they get that many people in position?
They had taken almost all of 1967 to secretly go down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and by other furtive means to supply the Viet Cong to get the North Vietnamese regiments and divisions ready. It was all done over the course of many months. It's interesting, in North Vietnam itself, there was a division as to how to fight the war. There were some who wanted to fight in traditional military engagements, but in any of those, the Americans just cleaned up. There was a second group that wanted to fight a guerrilla war, all right? And there was a third group in North Vietnam that wanted negotiations. So it's not as though the North Vietnamese themselves were unified as to how to proceed. So there was division in North Vietnam.
I mean, did they honestly think they could fight all the Americans and win?
The smartest of the North Vietnamese military leaders, like Giap, G-I-A-P, who lived to be 100 or 101, they had concluded pretty early on that in traditional military encounters, the Americans would decimate them.
So that leaves you guerrilla warfare.
So that leaves guerrilla warfare or negotiations, and they basically chose guerrilla warfare. And this points out another difference between, say, World War II and the Vietnamese War from the American perspective. In World War II, you knew where the front was. I mean, you know, it was up there and you were fighting the Nazis or you were fighting the Japanese. And when you were behind the front, you were essentially safe. In South Vietnam, the American soldier had to wonder who was the enemy. The enemy could be anybody at any time in Saigon and other cities. It could be even a child. It could be a woman. It could be anyone. So there was a completely different situation in the Vietnamese War compared to a war like World War II or World War I.
So is this when we start having, say, suicide bombers and things like that?
And there was some of that. There were a lot of guerrilla attacks. even in Saigon and so on. But it nothing like the Tet Offensive. The Tet Offensive was just overwhelming. It happened.
Okay, so everybody's having a happy New Year party.
And there's supposed to be a truce.
Everybody's all right? Celebrating.
And the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, South Vietnamese communists, they attack in over 100 towns and cities.
And they're just slaughtering people?
There's a lot of slaughter. Like in the city of Hue, which is in northern South Vietnam, it's the ancient capital of Vietnam, the communists slaughtered thousands of people.
Did they just go into homes and
murder families? Oh, yeah. I mean, women, children. I mean, it was ruthless.
And this was just a show of power.
Yes, absolutely. And the thing about the Americans fought back very effectively against the Tet Offensive, militarily speaking.
Well, weren't they caught off guard?
They were.
Or did we hear chatter and
we were just like we were caught off guard in the Battle of the Bulge in December of 1944, but we won it eventually. The Americans militarily decimated the Viet Cong. They decimated those who fought in the Tet Offensive. But this is the real kicker. By 1968, the Americans were getting tired of the war, and we were told we were winning it. And now you have the Tet Offensive. So even though the Americans militarily defeated the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, it was a propaganda victory for the communists. And the
How was it a victory for them?
It was a victory for them because people like Walter Cronkite and other news reporters,
All right,
academics and others said, wait a minute, we've been in Vietnam now for years and years. We've been in combat since 1965. We're being told we're winning the war. How can they launch an attack on 100 cities and towns if we're winning the war? And so even though we beat them back, all right, it looked like an endless war.
Do we have a definitive number of Americans that we lost at the Tet Offensive?
Yeah, I think it's around 5,000.
And how long was the battle?
Well, the first phase of the Tet Offensive was January into March.
Oh, that long.
Then the second phase was May into June. Then the third phase was August into September. So
and
you're
this
talking
all part of
you're talking most of 1968. And all of this is going on. Militarily, we're defeating them. But psychologically, they're winning. Because the Americans back at home are seeing this, and it's like, when is this going to end?
Now, is this when we start seeing the protests here at home?
The protests had actually begun even earlier, certainly in 1967, if not earlier than that. But the Tet Offensive made certain that the protests went on steroids in America.
That's when it really hit home.
And LBJ was now being blamed for this endless war.
And at this point, still, he's saying we can't invade North Vietnam.
Right. He can bomb North Vietnam, but...
But we can't just
go in
take over and get rid of these guys.
It was an incremental
war. Then how could we win this war?
LBJ felt, and his advisors, McNamara, felt that by attrition, we could get the North Vietnamese to the negotiating table. But they didn't care how many they lost. I think the kill ratio in the Vietnam War was 11 to 1. We killed 11 of the enemy to every one we lost. And that kind of kill ratio would ordinarily mean that you would win the war easily. But they didn't care how many they lost.
Because the value of life didn't seem to be very high.
That's a controversial matter, but I think you're correct. The Western value of life is very different from the Asian value of life. Many people might not like to hear that, but I think it's
the case. But if you're sacrificing 11 of your
care.
people to everyone.
Right. It didn't make any difference.
I mean, the numbers don't lie.
And the North Vietnamese and the Chinese and Russians who were backing the North Vietnamese knew only too well that there was more and more discontent in America against the war.
So they were playing that up, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And then you had, the students in America chanting things
like... Well, and
then
at this point, the draft is happening.
Well, the draft had been in existence since 1940, and it would remain in existence till 1973. But now it became very controversial. You had young men burning their draft cards, not wanting to go to war.
I mean, you could have gone.
I could have gone, absolutely. This is another problem with the Vietnam War. If you were in college, you got a 2S deferment as long as you were in college, but people who couldn't go to college didn't have that deferment. And a lot of times that fell back on the poorer element in America
If they couldn't afford to go to college, then they had to go to war.
And more so on Black America. So a lot of Black Americans served in Vietnam above and beyond the numbers of their percentage in America. Not as much as was sometimes said, but...
But still, they bore the brunt of it.
See, it tore this nation apart, and it's like, what are we fighting this for? And when you add to all this that many in South Vietnam didn't care for us. I mean, they were antagonistic to the Americans. There were some who were pro-American, but there were many who were not.
Was there ever a point where we thought, you know what, let's just cut our losses and get out?
Well, LBJ, on the last day of March 1968, and I'll never forget this. I remember watching this because it was supposed to be a major announcement by the president, and he announced that he would halt the bombing of North Vietnam, and he also said that he would not run for re-election in 1968.
Because of this?
Basically because of this, yeah. That he just wanted to dedicate the last 10 months of his presidency to trying to solve this situation. And so negotiations were opened up secretly in Paris, but...
By
in 1968, you had a major presidential election. You had Richard Nixon, the Republican, running against Hubert Humphrey, the Vice President of the United States, who got the Democratic nomination. And Humphrey was in a very difficult position because on the one hand, he had to support Johnson and the Vietnam War. But on the other hand, like some Democrats, for instance, Robert Kennedy, Eugene McCarthy, he was kind of disillusioned with what was going on. He was in a really tough spot. Nixon, of course, won that election, not by much, but he won in November of 68. And Nixon said he had a plan to finish the Vietnam War.
Is that what he ran on?
Partly. He ran on a lot of issues. America was a very divided country in 1968.
More than it is now?
No, I think as divided as America was in 68, and it was very divided. Campus riots, protests against the war, the anti-establishment youth going against the establishment, the drug culture. There was a lot of things going on. I think it's even worse now. We're divided again. And
seems like we just can't stick together.
Mm-hmm. But getting back to the Tet Offensive, militarily, it was an American victory. Psychologically,
victory.
Propaganda-wise, it was a communist victory. It's what really tipped the balance. And we began negotiations. Nixon's plan was to Vietnamize the war. That means that ARVN, the South Vietnamese Army, should take over more and
more.
Oh,
that we would train the locals to...
Well, we'd been trying to do that for years and years, and it wasn't working. And then he had Henry Kissinger, his national security advisor, engage in secret negotiations with Lee Duc Tho, a North Vietnamese representative in Paris. Eventually, this would lead to the 1973 Paris Peace Accords, which resulted in American involvement militarily ending in Vietnam, and with the hope that the South Vietnamese...
With us leaving completely?
Militarily, as far as any combat soldiers, yes. Last combat soldiers for America in Vietnam occurred in 1973. I think it was late March of 73, but it was sometime in 73. But the Paris Peace Accords allowed something like 200,000 North Vietnamese elements to remain in South Vietnam, which many felt was a prescription for ultimate failure by South Vietnam, which did occur by April of 75. Nobody really abided by the Paris Peace Accords, except the Americans, perhaps, because we were so sick of the war.
And it was probably an excuse for us to get out.
It really was.
And not lose faith.
I mean, we said we left with honor, but there are many who doubt that we left with honor. And I want to emphasize this. It was not the American soldier who failed in Vietnam.
I mean, my heart breaks for all these Vietnam soldiers who had to come back to such a volatile America.
Oh yeah, they were called killers and things like that. I mean, they were just doing their job. They were just doing what they're right. And they performed heroically at Khe Sanh, at Hue, in Saigon, at Duc Tho, in so many battles. Militarily, the American soldier did their job, but It was a political loss. It was a loss of nerve and so on. And when Clark Clifford came in as Secretary of Defense in 1968, when McNamara left as Secretary of Defense because he was on the verge of a nervous breakdown, Clifford was shocked. We had no plan for victory. He said, what's the plan? What's the goal? What's the end result supposed to be? And he said, I was shocked. Nobody had an end goal.
That just blows my mind here for a second.
Well, you could say the same thing right now about what's going on, say, in Afghanistan.
This
We've been there for 20 years.
It's repeating itself over and over and trying to train the locals to take over, and they just don't have the capability.
And this points out something else. Democracy isn't for everyone. I think America made a mistake thinking that democracy should be spread all around the world. Ideally, that would be great.
Yeah, in an ideal universe and world,
I agree.
That would be
I agree with Winston Churchill. Democracy is the worst form of government, with the exception of every other form of government. But lots of people don't want democracy, and we can't force it on them.
We can't. We've tried.
No. And sometimes, it has worked at times. MacArthur was magnificent, the way he ran Japan from 45 to 51, and Japan is essentially a democratic nation, I think very much thanks to America's enlightened treatment under General MacArthur of Japan. But many times it doesn't work. South Korea now is essentially a democracy. It didn't begin that way, but so it can work at times. Other times it doesn't. It's a great burden being the great power, whether you're Rome, whether you're the British Empire, whether you're America, whoever. And you realize that you can't fight everywhere and you can't fight nowhere. So you have to pick and choose your battles. And it's arguable that Vietnam might have been a battle in the Cold War we should have never fought in the first place.
So would there have been any difference, now looking back on it, knowing what we know, if we had never gone in there ever, would the result be different today?
That's a good question. There are some who maintain that our involvement in Vietnam gave Thailand a lot more time to prepare against any communist aggression. As an example.
Okay.
There are those who maintain that it was a noble cause because the real killing began when America left in 1975.
But that's always the case.
Well, after we left in April of 75, and by the way, Laos and Cambodia went communist that same year, 1975, under the Pathet Lao and the extraordinarily murderous Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. You had all the boat people, you had the exterminations and so on. And so a lot of the people who protested American involvement in Vietnam were suddenly silent when the real killing began in the late 70s, proving the point that Truman, Eisenhower, JFK, LBJ, Nixon had tried to make, which was that, and even Reagan said afterwards, it was a noble cause, but perhaps we didn't conduct it in the right manner. But I'm not so sure there was any manner that we could have conducted it in.
Because it almost seems like the result is the same, no matter what way you went about it.
Yeah, it's a puzzlement to this day.
So if you were to go to Vietnam today, obviously you'd still see echoes of the war.
Yeah, you would. I mean, Vietnam is kind of like China. It's technically a communist country. It's an authoritarian country. Freedom does not exist there. But they've kind of capitalized their economy. And in fact, when President Trump met the young North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-un, in Vietnam, one of the things he said to Kim Jong-un is, look how Vietnam has come back economically. Okay, this can happen to North Korea, too, if you loosen things up, if you're not so belligerent, etc. So
Because for instance, I have several pieces of clothing that are made in Vietnam.
Right.
I have no pieces of clothing that say made in North Korea.
No. If I had to live in North Korea or Vietnam, and they were my only two choices, I'm picking Vietnam in a heartbeat.
Even though the government technically
right.
is
Oh,
the
it's
same.
Authoritarian, it's communist, yeah, and so on, but yeah.
So does that come down to capitalism?
Yeah, it's capitalism, but you can't call it that.
Can you have capitalism without democracy?
I think you can. The Chinese are kind of showing the world that you can. I mean, I've oftentimes thought that once you develop a middle class and economic power among a large group of people, eventually they will demand political freedom as well. But maybe there will be a few exceptions to that rule. I don't know. I mean, I like freedom all around, economic freedom, political freedom,
religious
social freedom,
freedom.
Whatever. Right. I'm a big fan of liberty. But one of the things my study of history has revealed to me is that a lot of people are not like the ancient Greeks or the Dutch or the English, or the Americans. They're not lovers of liberty. They want other things more so, like security, authority, etc. Not every country produces a Benjamin Franklin and a Thomas Jefferson and those type of individuals.
But you would think once people have a taste of that, Once people have a taste of that freedom and that liberty, you would think that would almost create an addiction, that you need to have it. I think that's how Americans are.
That's how Americans are, but I don't think that's the way a lot of the world is. I think a lot of the world doesn't.
Even if they had a taste of it.
I don't, yeah.
Because it's not comfortable, maybe.
I remember very well what a Russian student of mine said to me when I was talking about the importance of freedom. And he said to me, you have to understand that a Russian looks upon freedom very differently from an American. Freedom to a Russian, he said to me, means being able to buy as much vodka as you want and being left alone in your apartment to drink it. That is not a Benjamin Franklin view of freedom. I think much of the world is authoritarianly oriented. We certainly see that with the Chinese today.
Well, and what they're planning to do to Thailand,
To Taiwan.
To Taiwan.
Yeah, all right, to Taiwan. Yeah, Taiwan is in the crosshairs. Although I think they have like the 14th largest economy, and they have a very significant military for being as small as they are.
That's kind of an interesting situation, because why aren't the Americans going in to stop the spread of communist China?
Oh, you know, Nixon opened up in 72 with China. We recognized them eventually in 79 under President Carter. We felt that engagement with China would make China free. Well, it hasn't.
We were
wrong. You can engage and not create freedom, which reminds me of what John Quincy Adams, our sixth president, said. We embrace freedom. We love democracy. We wish the world well, but we're not going to go around the world trying to convert you. If you wish to be free like us, good for you, but we're not going to.
I worry for Taiwan.
The stronger America is, the better off Taiwan is.
But sometimes the tyrants still take over, regardless. I mean, look
at
Vietnam.
Absolutely.
We were there.
Absolutely.
And the tyrants still took over.
Right. Well, yeah, but you could argue we didn't fight the war the right way.
But at such a high cost to us.
Yeah. And the one who really paid it was the American soldier. I mean, I have a great respect for American Vietnam veterans.
They're a very special breed of people. Oof, getting emotional here.
And they didn't have the backing that World War II veterans did, World War I veterans did, even Korean veterans did. Yeah.
Whew, wow. Okay. So we kind of ran the gamut with this one.
Yeah. Vietnam. We were in Vietnam from 55 to 75 for 20 years.
That's just ridiculous. And now we're in Afghanistan and
for
Syria
20 years.
And
right.
You know, different places
right.
in the
Middle Endless
East.
Wars are not, I think, a geopolitical approach.
We have to learn at some point. Well, I wish we had all the answers, but...
Nobody does.
Clearly. Clearly nobody does.
Nobody does.
Ooh, all right. Well, I think that wraps up our episode 19.
Yeah.
Now, next week, 2 weeks from now, is our 20th episode.
Wow.
So we're going to have to come up with something really good.
Okay.
For number 20. I don't know what that is. Listeners, if you have any great ideas that you'd like us to do for our 20th episode, you just send us an email through our website and let us know what you think.
Mm-hmm.
But until then...
Until then...
Be well, be safe, and we'll keep reading history.
Yes. Goodbye for now.
Well, friends, here we are at the end of the podcast. Be sure to check out the links in the show description to find some of the resources we used for this episode. Also, if you've enjoyed listening, please head over to Apple Podcasts and give us a virtual high five by leaving us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate that. And if you'd like to connect with us directly, you can find us at historicallyspeakingpodcast.com or follow us on Instagram at historicallyspeakingpodcast. That's it for today. And again, thanks for sharing part of your day with us. And remember, if you want to know what the future holds, study the past.